The State Board will come back to order. Staff, please call the roll.
Steve Durham.
Here.
It's on.
Dr. Flores, here. Jane Gobb.
Here.
Ken Nasnik.
Here.
Marsha Neal.
Here.
Dr. Scheffel.
Here.
Dr. Schroeder.
Here.
And before we start, I need to notice for the people in the audience that item number 7, which has to do with the consequences for failing to achieve a 95% participation rate, since that was handled yesterday, that will be canceled. We will not take that up on the agenda. And then, Commissioner, would you lead us?
Great. Madam Chair and members of the board, now we have our legislative update. I'll ask Jennifer Mello to come up and take it away.
And talk.
Sorry.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's nice to see you all. So in terms of just a kind of general report on where we are in the legislative session, we are, you know, getting close to the halfway point. Can you not hear me? I'm getting signals that
stick
I should
it next to your mouth.
Stick it right in my face. Yes.
Whoa.
Okay, anyway, I'm going to just let that one lie. And it's been actually rather slow on the education front, would be the observation I would make. I mean, there are a variety of kind of bills on singular topics, bills that you know, don't address overall systematic things, that have been heard. Some of them have passed. Some of, you know, are working their way through the process. Some of them are dying quickly in their first committee. But the 1202 Commission, as you all know, presented their results about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And I think that there's been a lot of behind-the-scenes work happening to in both chambers and in both parties to think about how to incorporate those recommendations into legislation. Nothing has been introduced yet. I think that particular piece of legislation, and it may be more than one, there may be different bills, but will really dominate our conversations in the second half of the legislative session. It's just because those aren't out yet, it's been a little bit slow. Initially, some of what I call the kitchen sink bills. So there's a variety of bills out there that address lots of different topics, right? So they address park and Common Core and accountability and 191. You know, they cross a lot of our big topics. A big batch of those had been scheduled to be heard in the House Education Committee this coming Monday. Those are not going to be heard in the House Education Committee this coming Monday. They have been pushed off into later in the session. So, again, that is, I think, indicative of the work that's happening behind the scenes right now to try to figure out, is there a grand compromise or are there different versions of a grand compromise that people are going to put out there in the form of legislation? And my interpretation is that they want those bills to be out there and discussed at the same time as some of these other, quote-unquote, kitchen sink bills are going to be discussed, even though those bills were all introduced very early in the session. So that is my kind of overall observation just about where things are and what's happening over there. The other thing that I think will dominate the second half of the legislative session when it comes to K-12 will be the School Finance Act, of course, and, you know, the conversation about how much of the negative factor will be bought down and how much of it is one-time money versus recurring money and all of those kinds of dynamics. So today, per the agenda that we distributed, we wanted to talk about two particular bills. The first is that I'm going to talk about is Senate Bill 173. This is by Senator Chris Hulbert, a Republican in the Senate, and Representative Dan Pabon, a Democrat in the House. The title is Concerning Expanding Protections for Student Data Privacy. So this is a bipartisan data privacy bill. There were a couple of other pieces of legislation introduced on data privacy that were not bipartisan, and both of those have died already in the process. So at the moment, this is the only piece of legislation that's still living that addresses this particular topic. And again, it's being done in a bipartisan fashion. Having spoken with Mr. Durham and Ms. Goff, it is their recommendation, my recommendation to you all as a board, they're your ledge contacts, that you all take a position of support on this piece of legislation. And let me explain a little bit more why that is. Last year, many of you will remember, there was legislation that the State Board supported that strengthened the statutory provisions around how the Department of Education deals with data privacy. I think it was a good piece of legislation. It was something we were proud of, something we were proud to work together with the legislature on. What that bill did not address was any requirements on school districts. It also did not address any vendor issues. That's what this bill is coming around to, right? So taking some legislation that was passed in California last year as a point of departure, and this is not the exact same as the California law. I will tell you, most people think it's much better than the California law. This bill adds a number of kind of requirements to vendors who are working with school districts, whoever they're working with in the state. Right, so it says it's not just the school districts and the department that has an obligation to preserve privacy, and of course we do. It is also vendors who have certain requirements on them about what they can and cannot do. This bill is going to be changed, and what it's going to do is add some of the language we put in statute last year around how the department deals with student data. It's going to replicate those requirements for school districts. So it will be even stronger when it comes out of its first, or when it goes, well, I can't predict exactly what will happen, but I think the sponsor's intent are to go into its first committee, present what's called a strike below amendment, which is kind of like starting over from scratch. Because sometimes when you're making a lot of changes to bill, it gets really hard to follow. And so it's easier just to say, okay, we're putting that aside. We're going to start from scratch. We'll maintain all of the vendor protections you see in the introduced version of the bill, and then add requirements to school districts that at this point in time the school districts are supporting. So, you know, we talked about this a little bit with the Ledge context, because knowing that the bill is going to change, does it really make sense for us to take a support position today? And I think the reason why we think it does is as a statement that just the vendor piece alone is a huge improvement over our existing policy. It's very consistent with the legislative priorities that you all have adopted for this particular legislative session. And, you know, we always reserve the right, it goes without saying, that if a bill changes dramatically in a way we don't like, we can come back and change our position. And obviously this is one we would be, if you all do decide to support the bill today, something we would be very involved in. And so if it were to change in a problematic direction, we would know that right away and we could revisit that discussion. So, questions about that particular bill or?
Questions, Board? Angelica?
So the title is data security, not data privacy. They're not necessarily one and the same. And so my question is, I mean, I don't know that you can even change titles anymore, but is it about data privacy and data security or security? I'm just thinking that distinction I find is helpful when you're discussing the concerns, because there are two different sets of concerns out there. Hacking is one concern, and that's about the security.
Mm-hmm.
Collecting information that we don't want collected is more about privacy. Mm-hmm. So that's just a question.
Madam
Jennifer?
Chair?
Yeah.
Vice Chair Schroeder. So you actually, once a bill is introduced, the title is one of the few things you can't change about a bill. But my observation from talking with the proponents of the bill is that they actually mean that term. I hear what you're saying. You're right. But I think they mean it as security and privacy. I don't think they're intending to limit the provisions of the bill just to kind of a narrowly defined set of data security issues.
I just like them to be aware.
Absolutely.
Of that difference and maybe put that in the body.
Any other questions, Board? Not. Do we have a motion?
I'll move to support the Senate Bill 173.
Okay.
Second.
Motion to move and second by Jane. Any?
Any objection?
Any objection. That's what I said. Any objection? If not, stands approved. Jennifer?
Madam Chair, thank you. So the second bill for consideration for action today is House Bill 1201. This is also a bipartisan bill. In the House, it's sponsored by Representative Bob Rankin, who is a Republican member of the Joint Budget Committee, and John Buckner, who is a Democrat chair of the House Education Committee. And it has a Democratic sponsor in the Senate, Senator Nancy Todd. This bill, and Representative Rankin, in full disclosure, had contacted CDE staff about this over the interim and said, I have this idea, but I could use a little help fleshing it out. So we have been, at a staff level, engaged in kind of the technical assistance part of this bill, just helping to make sure that, given his idea that if this were to be enacted, it's something we could actually implement. That, of course, does not in any way presuppose a position the board should or shouldn't take. I just want you to know that that has been a piece of how this particular bill has been developed. What the bill does is set up...
Excuse me, Jennifer, and I probably missed it. Did you give us the number?
Madam Chair, it's House Bill 1201.
1201, thank you.
May I continue? Thank you. So the bill creates a grant program that would go to BOCES. The goal of this grant program is so that BOCES can work with their member school districts who are rural school districts, the bill's specific to rural areas, to help them get some greater efficiencies of scale in what Representative Rankin calls, you know, kind of back operations, right? So this is the stuff that's not about curriculum. It's not directly about teaching kids. This is about, you know, bookkeeping and payroll and all the things you absolutely have to do in order to run schools and districts. Representative Rankin has a number of rural school districts in his area. And I think he, the way he is looking at this is I want to help these folks deal with the fact that resources are probably never going to recover to the level that everybody in school district world would wish they would. So how can we create some efficiencies so that we can continue to do a great job educating our kids? It is fair to say there's nothing stopping BOCES from working with school districts to do this now. They absolutely could do this under current statute. But this bill is providing an incentive to do that by tying some funding to a grant program. As introduced, the bill has a $10 million allocation for the grant program. That is a fairly substantial number in the context of the state legislature. And I think as the bill moves forward, I would imagine there will be some negotiations around that number. I don't know if it stays that big. I also don't know if it becomes part of the school finance conversation. So there will absolutely be talk about the money and how much money and where the money is going to come from. But I think the core of the bill, again, is something that is very consistent with your legislative priorities and in helping rural school districts, small rural school districts in particular, navigate this new environment they're in, where they have, you know, less funding in a way, more requirements. And so if we can help them structure their business operations in a way that allows them to better manage that, that's a good thing.
Questions? Gordon? If not, I would just comment that I do have a question.
Deb.
Question?
So I'm not clear on what the money would be for. So right now the districts can work together through the BOCES. They can pool resources. I mean, so what is the money for?
Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
They are allowed to use it in a variety of ways, and there is some anticipation in the bill that it wouldn't just be the grant money that goes towards these kind of consolidation efforts, that school districts would bring some of their own money to the table. I'm flipping through the bill here to try to find you a specific example. I think that the thought is that if you put some money on the table, and there's a whole grant process, and you all would need to adopt rules for that. This would be run through the department. So some of the specificity isn't in the bill, but it's talking about information management, data analysis, accounting services, human resource, transportation, food services, facility operations, security services, training for non-instructional staff. And I think the vision is the dollars get used to kind of fund some of those upfront costs. Maybe it's to hire the person to do the joint payroll, and initially those costs are borne by the cost of this grant. Over time, the grant is only, and I should have said this before, I apologize, is only 3 years. This is a three-year program. It cannot extend beyond 3 years. It's not an ongoing program. So again, the expectation is that if you can demonstrate the savings that districts achieve by working together, then it's in their interest to pick this up and go forward.
So I'd love to hear from the legislative liaisons. I guess on the face of it, I don't know that it's in the best interest of the district to centralize a program that encourages them to work together. I mean, I don't know. I prefer that those arrangements be bottom up. And when you have money as an incentive for folks to consolidate, I think that can drive things in a way that may not be anticipated by the bill itself, but I'd like to hear from the liaisons.
Jane?
Well, sorry. Going back to what several districts that are members of BOCES have been coordinating and cooperating on, and it's not necessarily, shouldn't be construed as putting all kinds of central headquarters, for example, for a particular function. It's an efficiency planning mechanism that if there are resources, I know in particular, there's always been some stress on personnel, certain people who are qualified and experts at various parts use data entry as one example where they could centralize in the sense of bring their resources together and their expertise, people who are able to coordinate the work. So I'm not sure if that's where we're going with that. It's not literally a centralized location. It's centralized planning.
So when you have a plan that has stipulations, it drives certain actions that otherwise may not have been driven from the bottom up, from the grassroots, that's all. But I wondered if I could hear from Steve.
I think it more facilitates.
You didn't ask. Steve? Yeah.
I think it more facilitates than drives the action. Participation is voluntary, as I recall in the bill. So I think it has a chance to yield a good result. I don't think it puts undue pressure on the districts. May provide some resources for them. So I don't think there's a negative consequence from the bill, and I think districts maintain significant flexibility.
Jane?
Yeah, one thing that I was pondering, and maybe Jennifer, you can help with a little clarification on that. The money, the funds are, the intent is to allocate funds from a state fund. Is that correct? So this is called a grant, but it is money that has been allocated for that purpose only, so that we're not necessarily talking about relying on our famous not so much liked phrase that pops up in bills, gifts, grants, and donations. This is an actual monetary contribute or allocation to the program.
Jennifer?
Madam Chair, you're correct that the bill does not rely on gifts, grants, and donations. It includes a specific allocation of resources. At this point, it's coming out of the State Education Fund.
I'm having trouble with my wheelchair. And the secretary is going to fix it for me.
Madam Chair, may I ask a question?
Yes.
Would it be for issues such as testing and
thank you,
all that goes along with that, where local pride LCDs don't have people within their district to help with this?
Jennifer?
Madam Chair, Dr. Flores, no. This bill is actually very intentionally and specifically not getting in any kind of curriculum or instructional issues.
No, I didn't mean that. I meant if they needed somebody who was going to look at data and help them with data. Oh, sorry. Thank you, Busy.
Madam Chair.
Jennifer.
Dr. Flores, I think data analysis could, in theory, be part of this. Sure, and kind of, if a number of neighboring small rural districts thought, yeah, it'd be great to have one data analyst to help all of us look at our stuff, I think that could be a part of it. That's a level of detail I would anticipate you all would address in the rulemaking process. It's not specified in the legislation.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Angelica?
I have two questions, if I can remember them both. Remind us how the grants are allocated. Are they applied for based on some costs that are identified, or are they just allocated based on number of kids or number of BOCES? Is that in the legislation?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Dr. Schroeder, it is addressed in the legislation, and it is an application process.
So the legislation outlines some kind of general criteria that, again, you all, I think, would anticipate making more specific through your rulemaking process. Having spoken with Representative Rankin, I can tell you that he feels quite strongly that it shouldn't be something that is just kind of allocated out so that everybody gets an equal piece. He really wants to use this as a way to test this idea and whether it works or not. And so he wants that to be done in a substantive, real way.
Kind of like seed money. Then my next question is, what is the impact, if any, on CDE? Do we have responsibilities other, I mean, do we decide who gets the grant, for example?
Madam Chair, Dr. Schroeder, yes, the department would administer the grant program, and because of that, we have, there's a fiscal note on the bill that we have submitted. There is some impact on us. The way the legislation is set up, I think the intention is that whatever costs we would have to administer the grant program, which are not gigantic for the record. I don't have the fiscal note in front of me, but we're not talking about, you know, $10 million worth of administrative costs, clearly, can be, it is part of that particular allocation, right? So of whatever the total amount that's included in the bill, a small component of that is identified to offset whatever costs the department incurs in administering the program.
And then do we approve of the grants based on recommendations from staff?
Madam Chair, Dr. Schroeder, I apologize because my computer just died. I believe it would work typically the way a grant program works, which is where staff takes the applications and then makes a recommendation to you all as the formal authority for the department. I'm just going to turn around and look at Elliot Asp.
You're looking the wrong direction.
And he's confirming that I am interpreting that correctly, even though I don't have the bill in front of me anymore.
Yeah, I apologize. I did not read it for the detail.
Okay.
I got the big picture. Thank you.
Okay. I would just say that while I admire the bill and Representative Rankin, who is fairly new to the legislature and may not be aware of the extent that we already use the BOCES boards, I'm in favor of it in general, but everybody needs to know, and I see Dale McCall is in the audience. We have very strong BOCES boards, and they do exactly what this bill talks about. So I'm not sure how much it would add to it, whether it would add things that we are not already doing. I don't know. I have no objection to it, and certainly if we want to support it, I would be in favor of that. But I just did want to point out that we have a very active BOCES board and certainly understand, and most of the BOCES boards are in my district, so other people may not be as aware of them. So that's just, I'm in favor of supporting it. As you say, you can always come back if it doesn't work out or something. I would be in favor of that. Do I have a motion?
Yes, I move to support House Bill 1201.
Second? Any objection? If not, stands approved. Thank you. Is that, we have anything? What? Do you have a problem? Are you okay?
Madam Chair, that concludes my report unless there are any questions from any of the board members that you'd like me to address.
Good time over there this year.
Madam Chair, I am having a great time at the Capitol.
Has a comment.
Thank you for asking.
Yesterday we had a little bump in the road with the approval of some rules relative to the allocation of trophies, and you may have heard about the bump in the road, but my understanding is Representative Perillo, who sponsored the bill that leads to the award of trophies, had offered at the time to cover the gifts, grants, and donations for the trophies. So when you're over there, would you get his check? It should be about $1,500, and tell him that I'll be by to see him as well.
We can get better trophies if we can get more.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Mr. Commissioner, Mr. Durham, happy to deliver that message.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Mello.
Thank you all.
Commissioner, I noticed that you did have some remarks before we move on. Yes.
Before we end our legislative report, I want to make the board aware of some issues that we've been talking about, and specifically with Mr. Durham and some of the rest of you around data privacy and Pearson. Next month at the March meeting, we're going to have a study session, I believe, for I think it's about an hour and a half or so. We're trying to get a room across a room at the Capitol that can hold a large enough audience. we're kind of trusting you if you could do that.
I'm trying.
Okay.
I now know what the process is.
Okay, good. We're counting on it. Okay. But anyway, it's specifically concerning assessments and related data collection. And CD staff, along with representatives from Pearson, will be there to provide, quite frankly, a brief presentation and to address questions. To help in the process, we've asked that, and we're going to open up a link on the board site and we'll advertise it. If people have questions that they want answered, it would help us to get us those questions, preferably by March the 2nd. That's a Monday, although we'll keep taking questions, obviously. But if we can get questions in, trying to keep acknowledging that we don't have all day for the study session, if we can get your written questions, we'll get information out. That will help us a lot. Again, if we can get through the questions, we'll have even more time to address anything from the audience. But this will help us keep the flow going as best we can, if that's okay with you board members.
And what is the date?
Thursday. It'll be Thursday, March the 12th. Is that correct? And I think it will be in the morning. It's just because of the amount of interest from the public and what people have talked to us, this room just won't be large enough. Okay. So, all right. I just want to thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. The next item on the agenda is a study session concerning graduation guidelines. Commissioner.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Back in March 2000, March, okay, seems like forever, May of 2013, the board adopted the graduation guidelines. And recently, you've seen a lot of press on this whole issue. That's obvious. But after you adopted the guidelines, one of the things you asked us to do was go out and get feedback across the state because some of the items that were set, you wanted more information on and more feedback. So between that time, once you adopted those, you've asked, again, that we collect all this information. We've had a group and a variety of people go across the state, gather information, and present back to you today. And today is only for information. I want to be clear about that. To just get your input. And if you don't like something, tell us, okay? We'll change it because we're going to bring it back to you in March, hopefully for action. If not, it can go to April, whenever. But what we're trying to do is because to help make sure we tell the field what really are the graduation guidelines, and they stand the way they are now unless you modify them. We really would like your feedback today or even next week, okay? So this is to get your input, and we've allowed an hour and a half today for the presentation, just kind of walk you through a bunch of the stuff that has been happening, the input that has been gained. And I think, I don't know if we have anybody here to speak. Did we have a couple of people? I thought so. Okay. With that, I'll turn that over to Rebecca Holmes.
Good morning.
Ms. Holmes.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Can I just ask a preliminary question? Local boards have control of graduation requirements. Is that generally correct?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
The legislation that was passed in 2008 indicates that these are graduation guidelines which local districts must meet or exceed. And so essentially the way that was handled in 2013 and in subsequent conversations with this body is that what you were asked to consider in 2013 and you're being asked to reevaluate at this point is a floor that districts use in then making local decisions and choices to set their diploma policies above that floor.
Yes.
So, and the legislature didn't enumerate those requirements. We set them.
Meet or exceed.
Is that, I mean, we set the floor, is that correct? You, the department, somebody does.
You all. Madam Chair.
Yes.
You'll see some statutory references in our presentation today that indicate some statutory references to where that floor must be set, that it must be aligned to higher ed remediation policy and aligned to the post-secondary and workforce readiness definition in the state. But no, they did not enumerate the specifics of that floor.
But once we enumerate them, Madam Chair, once we enumerate them, then they do become a standard, correct?
Madam Chair. They then have been interpreted as a standard that districts must meet or exceed in setting their own diploma policies.
Mr. Durham, could I comment to you?
Yeah, please.
I asked one day how many people had been in the classroom, and while many of you indicated you hadn't been there for a long time. But this is generally what the state has done. If you leave it totally up to local districts and that's it, most local districts just use grade point average, GPA, which can be inflated, can be nothing, you know. And that was the intent of the legislation at the time, that we need to have, you know, real standards. We're graduating, and I know this, we graduate kids every year that are not well educated. One of the ways we meet this, which I have always liked, is meet or exceed. If we set standards, that means that if the districts don't like those standards, they can come up with their own. So I just think in raising the bar, it's a really good opportunity for us to do that, because we have not had a very high bar for our graduation requirements. I probably shouldn't have editorialized. Go ahead, Rebecca.
May I have one more comment? Yes. I think the only comment I have is that, I mean, it's back to what I think we ought to have, truth in advertising. These are not guidelines. These are requirements and should be so labeled.
Meet or exceed requirements.
They're not optional. So
yeah, right.
The calling them guidelines is inaccurate. And I think we ought to have a policy of labeling things what they are. If they're requirements, they're requirements.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Commissioner.
I couldn't agree with you more, okay? But, all right, there's always but. The legislature made the statutory reference, which...
You talked to your legislator.
I couldn't agree with you more. It confuses it, but they made the statutory reference that you shall. And that's the issue here, you know, because guidelines mean guidelines. They're not mean requirements. But I'm bound by that legislation. It shouldn't be changed. And quite frankly, I don't want to make a recommendation to do that. But there was some talk that shall may turn into may. And then it's that option of the district. But they have stuck with what districts shall meet or exceed these guidelines. I just want to explain. It's awkward.
Okay? And thank you, Steve. Because we run into these things, this sort of thing, all the time. It is legislation. Until we change the legislation, we have no alternative.
You know, on some of this stuff, I have to bring up to the board. This is a good point. This happens to us a lot. There's some misleading nomenclature that's out there. And I think we all need to be aware of it. As it comes across, we need to try to make recommendations to change.
Deb?
Yeah, I think it's great for the clarity for the public, just because even though the legislative language may be obtuse, we need to clarify, because these actually... are where the rubber hits the road, where local districts are concerned. And I think of the word interim in the REDAC. It's an odd word when it's really an outcome assessment. So, yeah. I mean, I think clarity in labeling language is so important for districts, so that they understand it, for parents, so that they know how to think about the process.
Okay.
Thank you.
Now, can we let Rebecca?
Thank you.
Would you move ahead, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. I will add that we spent several months after the adoption of the policy in 2013 having this exact conversation with districts who also would prefer that the statutory language be more specific. I'm joined this morning by Dr. Elliot Asp, a special assistant to the commissioner, and Missy Ruthven, who you all know is director of post-secondary readiness. They'll be sharing in portions of this presentation, as they've been supporting this work over the last 18 months since the adoption of the menu in May of 2013. We have a significant amount of content, as you saw in your binders today, to try to cover, and in about 30 minutes or 40 minutes, we're hoping to transition to a panel of four educators from the state who've been deeply involved in this work and are here to share some of their perspectives with you today. To back up and provide context, back to about 18 months ago, this body did adopt the menu of college and career demonstrations to assist our state in a first-time definition of a high school diploma. During that discussion and approval, this body certainly directed department staff to begin a two-year discussion on the menu itself, as well ensuring that there had been robust public input and that feedback was received from a variety of stakeholders, including educators, industry, higher ed, and workforce representatives. Over the past 18 months, department staff has met with nearly every superintendent in the state, and you'll see some pictures of that process, as well as convened seven work groups by topic area with over 300 volunteers across the state to work on this policy. We want to acknowledge that when you go back and listen to the record of your hearing in May of 2013, when you all met to discuss and approve the guidelines, members of this board at that time mentioned no fewer than 8 times that the department should incorporate additional voices into the process and provide updates to the board with recommendations of additions and clarifications to the menu. And to continue to look for additional competency-based measures for districts and local boards as they reflect their learning priorities for students. Some of the comments that were made at that session that I think have guided our work from you all included that this was our first signal of student accountability, that it was the signal of a major shift toward competency-based outcomes and systems, but that more work remained to be done to understand exactly where the bar for districts' graduation policies should be set. I think one frame on this conversation that has become clear to us is that it is useful, I think, to think about the menu you all set not as immediately student-facing, but as a menu that is district-facing that districts then use to set and reevaluate their own diploma policies. If you look briefly at our agenda for this morning, which again is fairly tight, we want to start with some additional background and history about Colorado's graduation guidelines, outline the purpose of how and why our state began this conversation in 2007, talk a bit about the timeline that you all approved and the rationale for why this does not go into effect until 2021's graduating class. Share a bit about resources provided to districts, local boards, communities, and educators, our feedback from stakeholder meetings to share with you, the formation and ongoing work of the work groups, specifically the assessment work group, which was intentionally set to convene as the last work group and take in the work from the other groups. And essentially just share with you kind of a pause in the process and where we are. So I want to be specific that there's no intention to ask for any action today to revisit the menu. We just thought that given the gravity of this policy, that it is the first time there have been these minimums that students really must meet or exceed, that we would pause in the process and share with you the focus of the state conversation to this point. As the commissioner noted, the field is very eager to have what they would feel is a more final menu, and we do intend to come forward later this spring to ask you all to vote on recommendations to the menu. But we wanted to pause while that final work group is still working and get your feedback to take back to them so that we're having more of an iterative process and a conversation versus bringing something forward to you all that would have felt like a surprise if you hadn't had an update on the 2 years of work in between. So with that, we'll transition to some of the background here. You'll recall that in 2007, when the graduation guidelines were first written into statute, Colorado was the 50th state to establish at the state level some level of expectation for a high school diploma and define the meaning of a high school diploma. All 49 other states do have some level of state requirement that every district must include and meet and or exceed in their district policy. And at this point, the only requirement in the state of Colorado that districts must include is a course of a semester length in civics. So this is first time work for the state and was in 2007. The initial law adopted heavily focused on labor and workforce needs in our state and expressed the confusion for labor and workforce and higher ed with the fact that a high school diploma from one district might mean something very different from a high school diploma from another district. That said, I think it's always been the intention of this law to find a way to set that floor while still honoring our statewide commitment to local control and offering local districts as much flexibility as possible. The original council did convene in 2007. Their work deeply informed CAP4K, and when that was passed in 2008, graduation guidelines was rewritten into CAP4K, and at that point, the work group process paused in order to let the other pieces of CAP4K begin their implementation. That group was reconvened in 2012 and led to the menu adoption in May of 2013 with direction to the department to, as I've mentioned, establish an iterative process for updates. We have managed this iterative process in a number of ways. The first is clarifying for districts the timeline that you all set. When you adopted this policy in May of 2013, you were clear that it would go into effect for the graduating class of 2021. You can imagine there are some folks who have a sense of urgency and feel like that's a long time. In conversations with districts, they've felt it very important to remember that that's this year's sixth graders. And that while there is certainly a desire in the state to have a high bar for all students immediately, that it would be a troubling practice from the perspective of districts to change a graduation requirement on a student who's already in high school. And you all considered that testimony in May of 2013, and that was the rationale for what seems like a fairly long timeline, but would really allow districts to spend a year reconsidering the positive and negative consequences of their historic diploma policies, having a robust conversation in their community about what they want their diploma to include and mean, and another year to sort of put that work into place while those students are in seventh grade, and then a year for communicating new bar to students and parents in their eighth grade year, so that when that class of students began high school, their new graduation requirements, to the extent a district chose to update to align with the menu, were very clear for all families in the state. This timeline also allowed time to have conversation about the menu with an agreement that by May of 2015, you all would reconsider some of the pieces of the menu that needed additional clarification or were based on new assessments or new targets. And additionally, it has allowed CDE to begin providing district-level implementation supports. We have two pieces of implementation support that I'll share with you today, one that has been published as of December and one that is forthcoming in the summer. You also looked 2 years ago at the purpose for this work, and we have some new data from Georgetown that we want to share with you. Georgetown University for many years, past 5 years, has been releasing state projections of job growth, and we think this is critical. When you heard from Adams 50 yesterday in public comment, and Ms. Gatto remembered that in their district they talk very deeply about the fact that the day after graduation is the most important day in a student's life, and that we our system has the responsibility of producing students who will spend a lot more time in the world outside of school than they will in our K-12 system. And so we've grounded this work in the data that is shared here, where you see some projections about the world of work and the world of career and life that our students will go into. It ranks Colorado against other states and shares that by 2020, Colorado will be 48th out of 50 states in available jobs for high school graduates or dropouts, or graduates who essentially have no training beyond their high school diploma. We rank third out of 50 states in the proportion of jobs in 2020 that will require a bachelor's degree. But I also want to make sure we spend time on the third bullet on this slide, which says this policy is not about all students needing a bachelor's degree. It's about students being prepared for a world of work where the highest growth of jobs are. And you see that, those high growth projections are really around jobs that will have additional training of some kind, possibly a 2-year diploma or a certification program beyond high school. And this, I think, grounding in this data in all of our conversations with districts has been quite helpful to have a data reminder, a database reminder of the way that the world of work has changed and what the demands on our students really will be. So with that, I will take you to the menu that you all, the currently approved menu that you all considered in May of 2013. As you can see at that time, we did not know where CMAS or PARC scores would necessarily land. The baseline that the menu was built off of was ACT and SAT data, and that goes to the statutory reference around remediation rates. And we'll have someone from the Department of Higher Ed in our panel if you have further questions on the remediation cut scores. Colorado law also required that the menu be aligned, as I've mentioned, with higher ed's students need for remediation to show that they're remediation free and that they show work-ready skills regardless of the pathway that they choose, whether that's college, career, or military service. The menu's other goal was to provide flexible pathways for district-based decisions to allow more or less time to complete a high school diploma, as well as flexibility in a move away from seat time, or how students sort of demonstrate what they know. The menu, I think, is best considered as a menu that's district-facing, because a district might be able to choose of these 10 pathways, they might have 7 that comprise the options that they provide to their districts. In addition, they may add columns beyond what the state board has approved and say, our particular district certainly still wants to have requirements of PE or requirements in the arts. But that this venue, as you all consider it, is really the district-facing set of minimums. We'll be coming back to this menu later in the presentation. I mentioned that we have worked over the last 18 months to hear from districts what kind of resources would be most helpful to them. The thing they most want is an implementation toolkit, and that is forthcoming this spring. Obviously, it would have been premature to give deep implementation guidance before some of those TBD portions of the menu were complete. In the meantime, what we were able to provide them with that they asked for was a toolkit to work on their engagement policy. This was developed using some resources from CASB and other districts who had already deeply reconsidered their graduation policies. And the intention was to provide a toolkit that aimed at both superintendents and local boards in navigating conversations with their community about what their diploma policy currently was encouraging or prioritizing and how they might want to reconsider that. In addition to CASB and districts, we worked deeply with CASE to inform the content.
Yep.
Should we be interrupting or let this group continue?
Do you have a problem?
Madam Chair, I'm happy to take questions now, or we've set aside time for Q&A at the end as well.
Okay, I just have a question as I'm, again, kind of reconsidering this issue of guidelines. I just was looking back at my notes from when we passed this menu of options, 2013, is that right? And I specifically have language written into my notes and recall that the guidance from the commissioner and the discussion we had was around this issue of guidelines. These are merely guidelines. They're intended to help students know where they stand, help parents know where they stand with respect to competitiveness with on the ASVAB, for example, which is a military assessment. So, I mean, it was the idea of guidelines. And now I can't help but go back to that language and think we actually set requirements at that point with this menu of options and these specific cut scores on this table. And now our job is to consider whether or not those cut scores are correct and whether or not that menu of 10 things is the right menu to render kids fit for the workforce in 2020. Am I correct, Commissioner? Is that what we're considering, whether or not the menu is correct and the cut scores are correct? Because in my notes, it's very much, these are guidelines mostly for the kids and the parents so that they know where they stand in terms of competitive edge. Now I'm realizing that the word or was taken out and it's must, or whatever the specific word
is. Yes, Commissioner.
Shall versus
right. At the time of the when we brought this to you, the law hasn't changed. The board, this is one thing you do get to do. It's very clear, is set standards, set the graduation guidelines. Even though it says guidelines, it is in effect requirements. I would say that, and as Mr. Durham pointed out, he's absolutely correct. In a perfect world, the legislature should have said this is requirements. The way the legislation is set up, and it was set up clear back then when we discussed this, you shall meet or exceed these guidelines. So in effect, Dr. Chappell, you're correct. I mean, what was passed at that board meeting was set. They are the requirements, even though we call them guidelines by law.
What language in the statute would have suggested in our discussion that these were merely guidelines?
It's the way it reads in the statute.
So the word guidelines suggests one thing, and the word shall suggests a requirement. Is that correct? Was there any other language in the statute that mitigated the word shall?
No.
So it was just confusion based on the title of the bill?
Rebecca.
Madam Chair.
I was going to make a suggestion, and I apologize, Deb. You caught me kind of by surprise. In general, our rules, we ask clarifying questions while the report is going on and then bring up philosophical questions after we finish. And so
it's just sort of shocking to see those cuts.
No, I understand.
They're requirements.
Yeah.
Unless we change them.
But I just don't want to interrupt them too much, and then we can finish afterwards.
Madam Chair, could I say that it is difficult, I think, to just hold
what?
All of our questions, and I mean, when they're...
That's what we have generally done. Now, if you want to ask them...
I'm not arguing that that's what... But it would be helpful, I think, if we could ask when it comes up.
You can ask a clarifying question at any time. I will rep. But when they finish and we're talking the philosophical questions, is when we probably should be bringing those kind of things up, if that's okay with the board.
Yeah, and can I?
Sure.
I agree, and we'll respect that. My only thought is these presentations are so long that we usually
sometimes
have 5 or 10 minutes at the end to ask questions.
You lose them.
So I guess
understand
I would ask
that
the presentations might. We might consider that when we only have an hour to talk about it, and the presentation's 50 minutes. But thank you.
Rebecca.
Madam Chair, I'm happy to move on. I can also cite the statutory reference in 22.2106A5 that talks about the board's purview to set minimum competency demonstrations, if that's a helpful reference at this time.
Okay. Well, let's just move ahead then, and we'll finish up.
Okay. So we did go ahead, as I've said, and put out tools and resources to help districts begin this process. We wanted to share with you a way to capture the process of 300 volunteers and every superintendent in the state. That's a tough, and 2 years of work, that's a tough process to encapsulate in a presentation like this. We have chosen a handful of what I think are representative quotations in order to help capture that conversation. There have been voices of conceptual support. There are two quotations offered here that were, I think, representative of the kind of public support, both local in Colorado and national, from many websites that praised you all for adopting what you adopted. You can see the Denver Post quote from just that very week in May of 2013, talking about the meaning of a high school diploma. You can see a few months later a reference from CompetencyWorks, a national organization that has helped states who have set competency-based policies, and their president saying that this was a forward-thinking policy with a number of possible implications, going as far as to say to other states, for those of you thinking about state policy, it's worth taking a look. As the Colorado policy pushes forward while still leaving room for local control, you'll find that Colorado established a policy that allows districts to advance aggressively toward a competency-based system, but also allows others to continue to be time-based and credit-based in their structures. And then, of course, certainly none of us do our work primarily for the media, so perhaps our more direct constituents, a representative comment here from Gunnison School Board member and former superintendent Bill Powell that references his interpretation of the graduation guidelines as a creative reconceptualization of both classroom-level and school-level planning, thinking deeply about the teaching-learning partnership and allowing several learning pathways. That's not to say that the entire last 18 months have only had positive conversations. There are some very significant concerns that have come up about this policy. The first is about, I think, the complexity of the authentic adoption of a competency-based system. There are a number of states that have moved in the direction of competency-based, and I'll talk a bit more about what that means. We've also shared with you in your packets a brief article from iNACOL that summarizes competency-based systems and talks about the policy implications of them. But there is a significant shift if you move away from the Carnegie unit and seat time, which high school in particular has been based on for many decades, to move towards students really exiting a system based on a demonstration of what they can do. This complexity is, I think, well summarized in this quotation from a school board member from Telluride, where she says, "I think a standards-based diploma is a bigger deal than people realize. You can't make it so by a declaration. There is really more to it if we want to go to that direction and do right by our students. Without planning and resources, I expect either an ineffective system or a harmful system that leaves a lot of students behind. Raising the bar in and of itself does not improve outcomes. We need to plan better to implement a standards-based diploma by fully implementing a standards-based system and find the resources to do so in an effective manner." There was research shared with you all in May of 2013 that looked at other states that have raised their diploma requirements. And in every case, there was fear that if you raise the diploma requirement, the high school graduation rate goes down. In every case in the other states, what you have seen is that when you raise the diploma requirement, the graduation rate over time goes up. But it doesn't do so without thought about the complexity of the system and the necessary supports to help students understand the new ways that they would be asked to demonstrate their readiness for exit. The other significant concern you see here is one of cost and the important issue of access and equity. We've shared a comment here that I think is representative of many concerns from Superintendent Brett Miles, who I believe is also in the room today, about the need to think about the equity inside this system. And his final comment there, if a student has fewer chances to meet a cut score in a category, they have less chances of graduating. And so how do we provide enough multiple pathways that every district can craft a policy that gives students opportunities to demonstrate what they know and that they're ready for the day after high school? We also have had our own internal department learning agenda over the last 18 months. When Colorado adopted this policy in May of 2013, one of the reasons it made so many national education headlines is that we became one of about 8 or 10 states who've really made a policy decision relevant to competency-based systems. At that time, as you know, we had only one district in our state, Adams 50, that had already implemented a competency-based system. Luckily for us, they'd been at that work for about 5 years, and we were able to invest a significant amount of time learning from their lessons, their struggles, their system changes, so that we can share that work with other districts in our state. With 10,000 students, they are the largest district in the country that is 100% implementing a competency-based policy. We've also looked at New Hampshire and a number of other states, Maine in particular, who have adopted statewide graduation policies that are about competency rather than seat time to inform our ongoing work to understand how policy supports this move, and have spent a lot of time with a number of Colorado districts traveling to Lindsay, California, a small district outside of Fresno, which has also implemented a wholesale competency-based policy. And we've had a number of districts use their own time and resources to go visit that district as well as Adams 50 to understand different ways of moving forward as a district that wants to, as it's just an option, fully implement a competency-based system under the new graduation guidelines policy. I think the two areas we've learned the greatest amount there are about timelines and district supports. Most of the districts and states have said it's 5 to 6 years to authentically make this move, so that would support the timeline that you all adopted in May of 2013. And two areas where we have some good steps forward but more to do are the ways that accountability systems and school finance systems also have to move to truly support a competency-based policy. In particular, the fact that Colorado does fund beyond years 4 years of high school and can fund to the age of 21 and credit schools for a fifth, sixth, or seventh year in a graduation rate puts us ahead of other states in terms of some of our policy barriers, but that doesn't mean that all of our school finance or school accountability policy is ready yet for a competency-based system. With that, we wanted to give you a bit of a picture of where we are on the current elements of the menu. Very few of the current elements of the menu are new work to the state. Actually, every element of the menu you can find a district already working on, or you can find a number of districts having already put the groundwork in place. And so I've asked Misty to just very quickly walk you through a current picture of the elements of the menu and their current and historical implementation in the state.
Thank you, Rebecca. So in transition, let's discuss the data and information that we do have available. As Rebecca had mentioned, we want to be sure and outline the current data landscape for districts. So we will share specific maps with you today. You have all of this in detail, so we will go over this quickly. You have ACT statewide data, graduation rates, remediation rates, higher education matriculation rates, concurrent enrollment participation, advanced placement or AP participation, participation in career and technical education, and then we'll briefly discuss the career readiness pathways. So as we look at the ACT data, we cannot reinforce enough that this is just one reference point on the menu. It should not be assumed that students won't graduate based upon other measures in the menu as well, such as taking a concurrent enrollment course, ASVAB military exam, completing a capstone project, and all of these pieces Dr. Aspel will go into greater detail in today. I'd like to make sure and reference the by-region ACT data that you do have in your packet. So this goes into greater detail as far as the number and percentage of students across our state that are meeting the current ACT benchmarks of 18 and 19, which are aligned with the state's higher education remediation rates. One other piece to point out on the ACT data is that these are current juniors only. Many of these students may take or retake the ACT again during their senior year, and they may likely receive an 18 or a 19 in English and math on their subsequent retakes of ACT. Additionally, please note that our outcome data associated with ACT has not changed significantly over the past.
Misty, just a real quick clarifying question. I don't know region 1 through 15. Is there a map that I should be looking at? Did I miss that?
Madam
in order
Chair.
To get a sense for mm-hmm. what these regions are, was there a map that I missed tells me which are rural, which are suburban, urban?
Yes. Madam Chair.
Sure. So, no, because we have never shared that regional data publicly before, there's an attempt there to sort of anonymize that data. It's roughly BOCES regions. With the addition of the districts that do not belong to a BOCES into the region that would be their closest region, if you're looking for specific regional data, the ACT data map is the better way to get at that.
Is that online?
It is online, and you can also look at the end size of districts within those regions and sort out which regions have urban centers.
So it's a big secret. I got it.
if you're looking for also, I mean, the ACT data of any district is public, and so if you're looking for a particular
district, I'm just trying to get a sense for around the state whether I can tie resources to the scores or some other variable that can be really important to some of these districts, and I can't
A great question.
Without that sense.
We were interested in the outcome that when we categorized this in the way that we did, roughly BOCES region, but not entirely, the rough number of students hitting that 18 or 19 remained in a fairly tight range between about 52 and 60%.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Moving on to graduation rates, this is a snapshot of the 2012 graduating class. The darker color is a lower graduation rate, the lighter color a higher graduation rate. The purpose is to give you some context in alignment with remediation as well, which will be on the next slide. In your packet, you also have, these are just purely random samples of districts and schools, high schools across our state that have agreed to share their graduation requirements on a school-level basis. You'll likely notice that all districts, even some schools, have different scales for the number of credits and the minimum number of credits by content areas. This variability will continue as the statutory authority is to meet or exceed and establish a floor and not a ceiling, and districts will determine how they will continue, how they will align with this. As Rebecca mentioned earlier, we also will continue to have policies. The districts will continue to have differing policies regarding number of credits, seat time, and the amount of time a student must stay to earn a high school diploma. So these are all local level areas of decision and flexibility regarding graduation. Moving on to remediation. So, just a reminder, remediation is the need to take high school level courses in college because students are not prepared to take a college level credit bearing course. For higher ed institutions in Colorado, the students' remedial needs are only assessed in math and English. This map reflects students needing remediation in either math, English, or both. The blanks are students or districts that have fewer than 10 students attending an institution of higher education. And then the orange looks at districts that have higher than 50% remediation rates. The green is 25 to 50% remediation rates. And the the blue is the 25% or fewer of students who have remedial needs. And this is aligned with the graduation rate map. This is the same cohort of students that then would then matriculate immediately after high school into college. This gives you just a brief snapshot of our higher ed matriculation. Historically in Colorado, it has stayed fairly flat. This represents about 90% and does not encompass all students that go on to higher education. We know that the data that our partners of the Department of Higher Education are collecting are based on institutional data within Colorado, and then they do have access to what's called the National Student Clearinghouse. However, out-of-state schools are not required to report to that system. So moving on to some current programs in our state, this is a snapshot of concurrent enrollment. As we've shared with this board previously, more than 25,000 students across our state, or one in five Colorado juniors and seniors, take a concurrent enrollment course. And the vast majority, or 85%, of districts are participating. Advanced placement. We do have limited data regarding advanced placement. This is reflective of the districts that have students taking tests and not specific course-level participation. Moving on to career and technical education. As you may know, Colorado is unique in that career and technical education programs are administered by our community college partners. In many other states, these programs are administered by the K-12 system. CTE and concurrent enrollment provide an opportunity for us to partner with the community college system to align our pathways, which Rebecca will talk more about in detail. I'd like to just give you a few quick facts about CTE, or Career and Technical Education. This is representative of more than 125,000 students across our state. 37% of all high school students are currently enrolled in at least one Career and Technical Education course across our state. 95% of students taking three or more CTE courses while in high school. Most of them meet English as well as math competencies. But the other discussion is that 90% of students receiving a certificate get a job within a few months of high school graduation. So 90% of CTE students are getting jobs. There are currently more than 700 certificates available through community colleges and area vocational schools across our state with which our districts are partnering.
Did you say 3,700 or 1,300 or?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
700?
Thank you.
So more than 700. The exact number is 748. So in summary, program participation by school districts shows that there's significant participation in many programs that are represented on the Career and College Ready demonstration menu. From the maps, there is significant district participation in concurrent enrollment, approximately 85%. 56% of districts are participating in advanced placement, and 87% in career and technical education. I'll hand it back to Rebecca to discuss multiple pathways, which we referenced throughout today's presentation.
Sure. Thank you, Ms. Rebecca.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll pause here. We want to just name one of the inherent challenges in this menu, and that has to do with the fact that our definition at the state level of post-secondary and workforce readiness is essentially about college readiness and career readiness. And it has always been, I think, a stated value of this board when evaluating this work, that this is about students being ready for college or career or the military, depending on their choice. I think the question around how many certificates is actually a nice lead-in to one of the challenges in this work, where we've been trying to learn from other states. There is certainly challenge, but I think comparably, it's relatively easy to set bars for whether or not a student is college ready, because we have institutions of higher ed who tell us where that bar is and whether that is a 14, a 19, or a 25 on a particular assessment. Getting that same bar right for career readiness is much more challenging. There are 700 possible certificate programs in the state, over 700. And as a district leader or a former high school principal myself, you look at the idea that this is particularly challenging to sort out to whose bar is a student career ready. We don't want that challenge, and I think it would not meet our statutory obligations to not let that, to have that challenge around career readiness not give us something in the menu. But it is challenging to determine, how do we know if a student is ready for career? What career? At what level? When you look, for example,
we've lost our clicker. Okay.
You got bugs?
There we go.
There you go.
When you look, for example, at the work on career pathways, which is shown here in the career cluster model, trying to sort this out as a K-12 leader to determine, how do I align the rigor of my high school coursework, the participation of CTE, with any one, much less all of these career clusters, that is challenging. And one of the complaints that we've heard about the current menu from the field is that most of the items on the menu leaned toward career readiness, and that our districts felt it was incumbent on us to put forward a recommendation to you all around some element of career readiness. We've done that through looking at other states who have policies in their graduation policies or in their accountability frameworks that value career readiness as strongly as college readiness. And Elliot will share with you the one particular assessment that the assessment work group is considering most strongly as an addition to that menu. That said, the originally adopted menu did include industry certificates. And I want to point out what Misty said, that students who complete industry certificates before high school graduation are decidedly more employable than their peers. However, there's a challenge in that when you look in our career and technical education map and you see those high levels of participation, that is participation in one CTE course. that's very different. That's sort of a dabbling in CTE, which, while valuable, is very different than lining up the number of CTE courses leading toward the same career to graduate with a certificate. So there's still a great amount of work to be done there to understand where the bar is and what incentives you would put in place to help a student choose that path. I've referenced the work groups that we've had in place since the adoption of the policy in 2013. We had 6 work groups that took on different topics related to the menu, and those work groups essentially had 2 charges. Their first charge was to consider implementation guidance for their particular piece. So there was a group on ICAP, for example, the Individual Career and Academic Plan that is mandated in law for all 9th through 12th grade students. They spent a considerable amount of time saying you can't actually move to a competency-based graduation policy without strong individual planning for students. What recommendations do they make to us and to the field around strong ICAP implementation? And we were able to relaunch the ICAP process in a very large event in December of 2014 with their guidance. Similarly, the industry certificate group, as an example, looked at places where districts have had significant progress in helping students move toward industry certificates. They're working on capturing the best practices of those districts, and that will all be in the implementation toolkit that's coming out. So that was their first charge, to look at best practices in our state and others of work schools and districts that were already doing this work well. The second charge was to table their most vexing recommendations and pass those to the assessment work group. Given that it is in statute that the menu has to have some level of concordance between the pieces of the menu, we knew that there would be topics that would come up that were better considered by one group than separately considered by 7 separate groups. So the 6 groups did consider a number of those and then sent those to the assessment work group, and that has helped shape the assessment work group's work. The assessment work group kicked off last intentionally to have that be facilitated. And so that's why today we're going to focus, I think, the remainder of our time heavily on the current work of that assessment work group, because in many ways it is a culmination of the other work groups that have taken place. I do want to point out that we had a special populations work group that was intended to think about the implications of the menu for English language learners, students with IEPs, and gifted and talented students. For resources, we tried to call that one group. They immediately, in their first meeting, understood what we probably should have understood, that those are 3 separate groups. They split into 3 separate subgroups based on their special population of students and have put together a particular set of guidance that will come out in the implementation toolkit. That group has made those recommendations, and you'll see that those recommendations will come forward the next time that we bring this work to you. The work group membership, as you can see, was over 330 volunteers from across the state. Each work group was chaired also by a volunteer, in some cases a subject matter expert from the department, in other cases a subject matter expert from a district or another institution. And you can see the breakdown here of K-12, rural, higher ed, et cetera, in terms of participation. With that, as I've mentioned, the assessment work group was last, and that is the group where we ask them to pause where they are in their work right now and bring this work forward to you all to have a bit of a conversation, not only with us, but essentially via us with them, so that we can get to a place by the end of this spring that we can put forward that implementation toolkit and give districts even stronger guidance than they've had so far. So because Elliot Asp has chaired the assessment work group, I'm going to hand things off to him at this point, and then we'll move to our panel of members.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Well, it's been my pleasure to work with the assessment work group, and I appreciate the opportunity to share the thinking of this group with you this morning. I'd like to focus our attention back on the original menu and the charge of the assessment work group itself. I want to remind you that we're not asking for a formal recommendation from you or a vote today. What we want to do is to provide you information on the direction the group is going, and so that you understand the nature of the discussions that have gone on inside that group, and also the feedback that we've received from a number of stakeholders across the state regarding this work. Folks have not been shy about wading in on this process, and that's been good. Let me remind you just a minute, the charge of this work group was really aligned with a directive from you folks in May of 2013. So we've charged them with allowing time for additional conversation about career and college-ready demonstrations, what additional things we need to be aware of, to explore additional competency-based demonstrations, and ensure that the menu is aligned and iterative. And what I mean by that is that the cut points in these various measures are aligned with one another in a very deliberate way. Now, more specifically, this group is focused on examining what aspects of the current menu need to be revised, if any, exploring content areas and additional measures, especially given the recent discussions around assessment at high school and how that may play out in the legislature during this particular session. And then they've also been incorporating feedback from stakeholders and other work groups regarding the feasibility and utility of the current menu and its implementation. As we've had these discussions, a number of issues have arisen or questions have arisen that we've been talking about. I'll just give you a flavor for a couple of those. One interesting discussion point was, is the bar post-secondary and workforce readiness or post-secondary and workforce success as demonstrated in high school? Okay. How can we provide flexibility to meet the needs of the vast array of districts we have across Colorado that are varied in their capacity? How can local assessments be included and added to the menu? Frankly, the question came up, and we'll talk more about it in a moment. Should students be required to demonstrate post-secondary and workforce readiness in all four content areas? And do the cut points across measures need to be altered for alignment purposes? One of the first things we did was go back and take a look at the statutory minimums that Rebecca and Misty have already referred to and that you've asked some questions about earlier. And we put the major ones up there on that slide. The first one is to ensure that state graduation guidelines are aligned with the description of post-secondary and workforce readiness. I'll come to that in just a second. Including but not limited to minimum required English language competencies, which were adopted by the State Board and the Colorado Commission on Higher Ed. And then the second piece there is that the Commission shall establish and the Governing Board shall implement a policy pursuant to identifying matriculated students who need basic skills courses in English and mathematics. So when we read those pieces, what we see there is the basic requirement is in English and mathematics in terms of demonstrating post-secondary and workforce readiness. And one of the first discussions we had, and I'll come out back to that in just a second, is whether or not, as in the current menu, we should include all four content areas, or is that going beyond the scope of what the legislation intended? And so there's been some discussion about that, and I'm not trying to take a stand on either side, but to give you a flavor of what folks have brought to the table.
That's all right. I will later.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought you might weigh in on this one. The other piece that's more open-ended than that was the alignment with the state's definition of post-secondary and workforce readiness, which is the knowledge and skills and behaviors essential for high school graduates to be prepared to enter college and the workforce and compete in the global economy. So let's take a look at a draft discussion memo that's come out of our discussions in the assessment work group. This is in no way a final document. The group hasn't signed off on this as some consensus, but it does reflect the discussions that they've had. And we wanted to bring this to you to get your feedback and input into this process so that we can make sure we define the boundaries around where we need to be when we bring a recommendation back to you later this spring. Okay? The first piece you're going to see that's different, and we'll highlight the differences in a major way a little bit later for you in some slides, is that this particular draft menu narrowed the subject areas where students need to be post-secondary and workforce ready to English and math. The rationale for that coming out of the assessment work group was the need to be aligned with the higher education remedial policy, which focused on mathematics and English. Now, when you look at the first line there, easier to see in your packet, the ACT has not been changed. The ACT benchmarks are established by the Colorado Department of Higher Education, and students that meet these benchmarks can take credit-bearing courses without the need for remediation at any institution of higher ed, public institution of higher ed in Colorado. The second indicator there, advanced placement, created a lot of discussion around this issue of post-secondary readiness versus post-secondary success. In the original menu, the current menu that's in place right now, there's the cut point on AP was 3. 3 in a lot of institutions allows a student to get credit for a course they took in high school. So they don't take that course again, they get credit for that. The discussion in the group was that almost demonstrates success at post-secondary education in high school rather than indicating readiness. And so there was a discussion back and forth about whether or not three should be the indicator, whether two should be, and seeing that having all kids in Colorado even take an AP course would be a major step forward, and to be somewhat successful on the final exam is one that might indicate readiness. Again, not taking a stand there, but so you understand the discussions that have gone on in this room for about 6 months or so. Next piece that's we've been added there is the ASVAB, or the Armed Forces Vocational Aptitude Battery, that Dr. Shuffle, I think, mentioned earlier. This 50 indicates the cut point that the developers of the assessment, the users of the assessment, set for students to be, for students to be able to enter into career training that in the armed services. This is higher than the entrance level to get into the armed services. This would allow students to move into very sophisticated career training. Now, there's some differences between the type of career and the scores on the ASVAB, but we're in working with the developers of the assessment, the 50 seems to be a reasonable place. The next piece there, you see, is the concurrent enrollment indicator. This one raised a lot of interesting discussion as well, and that has to do with how local districts establish criteria for whether or not students can take those concurrent enrollment courses and have their tuition paid for by the district. That's a local decision now. Some districts require that a student get a B in the course. If not, they don't meet that bar that the family would have to pay the tuition back. Some have set it as a C. There's a few districts in the state that have set a lower bar. So part of the idea of saying a passing grade there was to reflect some local control pieces there. There's folks on the other side of that issue that say this needs to be a statewide bar and that we need to establish a specific grade. The next criteria there is a district capstone. We've had, as Rebecca mentioned, a capstone work group taking a look at that piece, and they're compiling a report and they're developing tools for districts and schools to assist with the idea of a capstone implementation. What this really means, and we're going to hear from one of our panel members in a few minutes about how that's been implemented in their in her district, but basically we're talking about an overarching project that a student might do toward the end of their high school career to demonstrate their competency in post-secondary and workforce readiness. Again, we've set up some statewide guidelines for those that are being developed and being shared with districts. The next category is industry certificates. You heard about the vast number of those that exist in this state. We're still working on guidance to bring for districts to decide which of those certificates and how they might be used to really signal post-secondary and workforce readiness on a more comparable basis across the state. IB raised another interesting issue for us, and it relates back to the AP discussion or the AP issue that I talked about earlier. On our original menu that exists now, there was a specific score on IB exams that was listed. We've had districts who have robust IB programs come forward and say those exams aren't graded until, in some cases, the student has actually graduated, and so it would be much too late for a student to use that as a pathway and then find out as they're moving toward graduation in the final days of their senior year to find out they didn't meet that criteria. So part of our discussion is how could we look at IB in a different way, and that's where part of the idea of a successful completion of a certain part of the program. Another indicator that's added there is the PARC assessment. This is a very interesting one for us for a lot of reasons. PARC has developed a set of performance level descriptions on their assessment that one of which would indicate college and career readiness in math and in English language arts if the test was taken at the 11th grade, if they scored at a 4 out of a 5-point scale on PARC. However, that that four hasn't been verified as a in an empirical way, in the same way that we have seen with ACT, where a certain score indicates a high probability of being successful on a course in college, or and with our Commission on Higher Ed, a score indicates that a student's ready at least for post-secondary collegiate work. There's discussions inside of PARC about conceptually how will we determine that particular score and define it. Are we going to do it in terms of a high likelihood of getting a passing grade in a college course, or is it more aligned with the idea of not needing remediation? So that's still up for consideration, and our guess in doing this work is that as this flows out, particularly as we learn more about some of these assessments that are new, there'll be some changes required to some of these cut points as we move ahead. And finally, the ACT scores are set basically in the same way. They correspond to the ACT remediation level scores from the Department of Higher Ed. Well, let me move on and just point out some pieces that have been added to the menu, at least suggested additions, by the work group. Most of these are pretty straightforward. The first one was to include the ACCUPLACER, since that's one that a number of community colleges as well as high schools and districts currently utilize to place students either in collegiate courses or to track their progress in K-12. And so it made sense from a number of people on the group to add that. That's the same thing with ACT Compass. It's similar to the ACCUPLACER. Again, districts and schools use it for placement currently. Rebecca alluded to the next indicator earlier here, and that's ACT Work Keys, which has a National Career Readiness Certificate. The Work Keys program has been greatly enhanced over the last several years. Students can earn certificates that allow them to move into career training programs. A number of states are using Work Keys as a way of identifying or credentialing kids to be ready to enter career programs. And so it's a piece that generated a lot of interest in the group. One that's particularly interesting to us was the use of, we coined the term collaboratively developed assessments, and that was to try to make the point that we wanted to find some ways, at least in our discussions, that we could bring local assessments to bear in this process, that districts could develop their own. In some sense, they're already in the menu in the form of a capstone project that a district could develop. But we're not talking about local assessments like the test I might give in my seventh grade science class at the end of a unit or end of a week. We're talking about a common assessment we might use across districts that was developed by, say, teachers in a particular district or a group of teachers from across the state that's vetted in a way by the state that says this is a indicator and we'd have an opportunity to set appropriate cut scores on that assessment and so on. But we've had a lot of interest in people saying we'd like to bring that to bear. There's another connection here that's interesting around this local or collaboratively developed assessment piece, and that would also allow us to think carefully about engaging in some accountability pilots where we could build a system that has some state testing but also has some local testing in it and bring those two efforts together. Some of that conversation came up yesterday in the discussion of our waiver. And my final slide here is just to take you down and review proposed updates or coming out of the discussion draft menu that, and so we can summarize that for you. Obviously, you saw that the discussion menu focused only on English and math, but then as you can see from the slide, ACCUPLACER was added to the menu with the cut scores being ones that were referred to us by the Department of Higher Ed. ACT Compass was new, as well as ACT work keys, as well as the collaboratively developed performance assessments, and you can see also that we went back and added the change in the advanced placement and international baccalaureate and PARC pieces that were there earlier. Now, just a reminder again, we wanted to put this out there to hear your feedback about the discussions the group was having to inform their work. And again, not asking for any kind of recommendation from you today. This group has two more meetings, as Rebecca said, prior to the April meeting, and we've brought some folks who have either been part of the group with us today or have advised us along the way in this journey, and I'd like to invite them to join us here, and we'll introduce them to you in just a minute. So we have our panel join us, and I'm going to move down here. I think we have some name flavors. We're excited to have these folks join us this morning.
Yes, Deb.
I'm just noticing the time. We have about 25 minutes left, lots of presentations. But we have additional time and additional meetings to really talk through this. Presentations
yes,
are
yeah.
great, but it's well, really high stakes for the
we have a request to take a bathroom break, but then we can, okay?
Okay, but we won't be able to today, so when will we be able to?
Oh, well, I thought we will have time for discussion today. If we don't have enough time, we can set some more for March.
And we're going to need a lot of time to discuss
okay.
that.
All right.
Thank you.
Yes, who am I calling on?
Let me just introduce on my far left over here is Scott Stump. Scott's the Chief Operating Officer for VIAC. If I said it correctly, Scott, I apologize. I probably didn't. Scott was on the 2012 Council, as well as he's been the Vice Provost of our Community College System and the State Director of Career and Technical Education. And he also brings a school board perspective to this because he's on the school board of Prairie School District up in northeastern Colorado. Next to him is Holly Sample. She's principal of University Schools in Greeley. This is a charter school in Greeley that you may have recalled the University High School that was a magnet school of UNC quite a while ago. This has now been incorporated in the charter school that Holly is the principal of. Next to Holly is Jennifer Sauvignet, the Chief Operating Officer of the Department of Higher Education, and we've been working closely with those folks, our partners across the street. And finally, to my left here is Dr. Floyd Cobb. He's the Executive Director of Curriculum Instruction in Cherry Creek School District. And each of these panelists have just a few minutes to provide some comments from their perspective, and we'll start with Scott.
All right, thank you. Mr. Stump, go ahead.
Madam Chairman, it's an honor to be here, members of the board, Commissioner Hammond. As a member of the 2012 Guidelines Council that worked on these, I can just give you the perspective of what the thinking was of that group coming to the table here in May of 2013 to say, this is what we recommend. And so, and from my perspective, there were really three things that were a part of it. And do know, full confession, I did have a son graduate from high school in that May of 13 at the same time that we were putting together these guidelines, and I've had another one since graduate this past year. So very important topics to me. And as he said, coming from a rural school district, try and bring that perspective to the table as well. But there were three pieces that I would say came up with a part of the discussion that are still salient now that should still, in my opinion, guide the future discussion. One, what's the value of a diploma? And now, having moved from the community college system, public employment, to private employment with a company called Viveic, we'll get the name right, there we go.
Thank you
did a nice job as you went along. And working with companies like John Deere and Monsanto and American Farm Bureau and other entities, there is a question out there of what is the value of a high school diploma? And if it's not consistent across the state, how do employers know? And that was originally the very beginning of our conversation as a council to say, how do we say that there's a currency and a value to this diploma unless we can say exactly what that is? The second piece, then, is this notion of rural school districts. And as a board member, I do pay attention to our students going through. We only have 12 to 16 graduates a year. In fact, our classes are capped at 16. So how do we, in that small environment, with a student that is potentially at a 36 on their ACT to one who is under that 17 or 18 mark, how do we create something that one diploma fits all of those students? Well, the key is you can't create one diploma that fits all of those students. You have to set a mark of not what has the student attained getting here. It is more, what does the school verify that this student is ready for as they move forward? And that's the value that we placed. And so on that notion of small schools, we said they need multiple ways. One score is not enough to define that parameter for all students. And, in fact, students show up smart in lots and lots of different ways. And working with Career and Technical Education, we have students that are aptitude off the chart in mechanical as well as health or other related careers that you saw on the cluster map they need lots of ways to show those. And from what I heard on the comments, it doesn't appear that we've come up with enough ways yet in that menu of opportunities to give them options. But that was the goal, was to provide plenty of options and multiple ways to show they're smart. The third piece, then, was making sure that the target is not baccalaureate entrance. And again, it was my responsibility as the CTE representative to say, you know what, there are all kinds of certificate and associate degree options out there that individuals can, with some post-secondary training but less than a baccalaureate degree, end up providing a wonderful family-sustaining wage and being a contributing member of their community. And so, you know, currently the ACT score is not set for full baccalaureate entrance into college algebra. It's set for entrance into math for liberal arts, which is intended to be that lower mark. But, you know, again, that may need to be looked at, because for industry certificates, that mark is a little bit less on the math and goes closer to the Accuplacer score that Elliot, I was so glad to see, was in there of 61, which is entrance into clinical calculations for health professions. Yeah, so really those three things. What will give the diploma value, what will allow all districts to have lots of options for all students to show that they have attained a measure that warrants the diploma, and making sure that we don't set the target that all students are headed to baccalaureate degrees, because I don't think that's what's right for the state of Colorado.
Thank you, Scott.
I'd like to turn to Jennifer.
Sure.
Yes.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Jennifer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board, Commissioner Hammond. I really appreciate you giving us the opportunity to come and talk to you today about the work that we've been involved in with you and with the staff at CDE throughout this process. First, just to give you a little bit about myself, I'm currently the COO of the Department of Higher Ed. I've spent the past decade working at universities and colleges across the state. Prior to that, I was actually in the private sector working primarily in finance and management consulting. I want to hit two main points today. The first one is just to give you a flavor for the partnership that we have between our K-12 system and our Department of Higher Ed and all of our institutions of higher ed across the state. And then secondly, I want to talk to you specifically about the remedial and admissions policies that the commission is responsible for and how those align with the grad guidelines that you all are responsible for. So first of all, I just want to give you a flavor for our partnership, and it's been very robust, very cordial and really great partnership that we've had with CDE. I have to thank Commissioner Hammond for the really truly the amazing staff that we get to work with over here, and the way that we can really debate through the issues and through a really iterative process. And you saw that process described by Rebecca and Elliot earlier today. And we have what we have, as I think our two agencies, is a mutual goal. It's to ensure a seamless P20 pipeline for Colorado in which K-12 students leave high school prepared to be successful in college and careers. A big part of this relationship that we have together was seen certainly in the work that you all have done, where the State Board of Ed and our Colorado Commission of Higher Education, we were legislatively directed to work together in developing the PWR description, which we jointly adopted with you all on June 30th, 2009. And then in August 15th, 2013, we together, you all and the commission, adopted the PWR endorsement criteria. So there's an example of how we've worked together with our boards. And then also how we've worked together with our friends here at CDE. We've worked together on the P20 work groups that you saw explained earlier today. We've had not just staff from the Department of Higher Ed who are involved in those work groups, but also our faculty and our administrators from our various institutions of higher ed have been involved in those work groups. And so I just want to recognize Dr. Rhonda Epper, who's in the audience with us, who's helped with these from the Department of Higher Ed, as well as Dr. Ian McGillivray and Carl Einhaus, who've been on these subgroups, in particular the assessment work group Dr. McGillivray has been on, and then the PWR and the ICAP work groups we've been a part of. And so I just want you to understand that there's been a constant back and forth between these two departments on this work. Secondly, I wanted to talk specifically about our partnership to explain the link between the State Board of Ed's grad guidelines and the CCHE admissions and remedial policies.
So the State Board of Ed grad guidelines are legislatively required to be aligned with the commission's admissions and remedial policies to ensure that students who are admitted into institutions of higher ed are ready for college coursework. The new admissions policy, which was most recently updated actually through our commission in our December meeting, begins as early as fall 2016 and states that students admitted to four-year institutions must be college-ready as defined by the commission's remedial education policy. So those two work hand-in-hand with the grad guidelines. Now, given the reality that not all of the admitted students are college-ready, the commission policy allows institutions to admit students who score below the cut scores, but requires that their remedial needs are met before they are allowed to enroll in college-level math and English. The remedial policy has cut scores only for English and math, as Rebecca had mentioned earlier, because students have to be proficient in these two content areas to succeed in other college coursework. The CCHE remedial policy has existed since 2003 for ACT and SAT, and its purposes are to ensure that students admitted into institutions of higher ed are prepared to succeed in college-level English and math, to ensure consistency in how institutions identify students with remedial needs, to provide options for students depending on their level. Some might need just some supplemental academic instructions. Others might need full-on basic skills remediation. The scores for both ACT, which you saw on the slides, 18 in English and 19 in math, and SAT, which is a 430 in English and 460 in math, are the same on all menu options for graduation guidelines and are in alignment with the Colorado's remediation policy. CDHE, the department, works closely with our institutions of higher ed to set those figures, and we look at national research as well as our institutional research to determine what those should be. And then I just wanted to end with CCHE's remedial policy is a living document, just like I'm sure all of the work that you all do is a living document. And we do have an iterative process that allows us to be able to adjust as things change.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, we go to Holly Sample.
Holly.
Joining us from Greeley today.
Madam Chair and Board, thank you for the opportunity to be here, as well as Commissioner Hammond. I am happy to share with you some information about university schools' graduation requirements. I've been asked particularly to focus on one of our requirements, which is the senior project, as an illustration or example of perhaps the capstone item that is on the menu. But to put that in context, I'll first let you know that I have been at university schools for the last 9 years as the high school principal. We are a K-12 school that, as Elliot mentioned, was once the laboratory school at UNC and became a public charter school in 2000. Our graduation requirements include a pretty rigorous credit requirement that was aligned to the previous CCHE higher education admission recommended sequence of courses, and that's 29 credits in math, science, social studies, world languages, a variety of things. In addition to those credit requirements, we require that all students who graduate from our school complete 50 hours of community service, perform 3 job shadows, participate in a 50-hour internship, and complete a senior project, capstone project. The senior project's been a part of our requirements for over 20 years, and it continues to evolve as we improve, I think, our implementation of the project. But some of the examples this year of projects that our students have approved and are currently engaged in preparing are things like a girls' engineering camp, writing books or anthologies, developing websites, creating gardens such as a butterfly habitat garden with the second grade, building trails through a wetlands area near our school, which involves the permitting process, a collaborative process of, you know, coming up with the funds, developing fish habitats in local gravel ponds, artistic performances, and a variety of other things. Students choose an area to study and that combines different disciplines in order to explore new avenues in a productive manner and then at the same time make a contribution to the community. Every student has to address a challenging issue that will stretch his or her intellectual and personal growth and become a significant learning stretch. And then it should also be relevant to the community at large and or give insight to a field that he or she may want to pursue as a career. We require students to obtain a mentor outside the school to support and help them through this process. They document their field work, and then they present their project to a board that includes community members as well as teachers for validation at the end of the process. I know that some people think in terms of the this being an easy out, perhaps, you know, with the cut scores, and that's not the case at our school at all. In fact, it's very difficult, and students really do have to stretch. There's a variety of complexity in the projects, but all of the students demonstrate, in addition to some academic competencies, some professional competencies in things like collaborating, designing projects and implementing them, being able to manage their time, as well as learning from failure, perhaps, because experience is a powerful teacher, but you don't always get the lesson that you're expecting. Finally, I'd just like to use this opportunity to share my perspective as a member from the field about a few of the items before you. The commissioner mentioned nomenclature, and I'm a little concerned about the idea of seek time or competency. Thinking of it this way can be a bit of a false dichotomy, because competency can and should be demonstrated through coursework as well as projects and assessments. So, you know, there's a growing body of research that indicates that persistent effort and in schooling, which is often called academic grit, leads to higher levels of economic success in adulthood. And this actually does point back to the importance of the GPA and the old college index scores that many of us are familiar with. Carnegie units and competency measures combined are what I feel are the best way for graduation requirements to ensure that students are college and career ready. It also gives us an opportunity to ensure that our standards are all met if there are not particular standards reflected in those assessments that are on the menu. And so I would just like to encourage you to think along those lines. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, last speaker is Dr. Floyd Cobb from Cherry Creek.
Mr. Cobb, no. Dr. Cobb.
Madam Chair, members of the board and Commissioner Hammond, thank you all very much for allowing me to speak to you today. What I plan to talk to you about a little bit is about the process that we've gone through as an assessment work group. I certainly want to commend Dr. Elliott Asp in the work that he has done in bringing together, I think, a very eclectic group of educators who are very committed to making sure that all of us, or the work that we do as a part of this group, is a goal for increasing the outcomes of the students that we serve. I think as we've talked about this as a group, one of the things that's come up a lot is really a strong opinions on both sides, and I think that's been good. And I think a lot of it has hinged around the conversation specifically related to our system of our seat time based system currently and shifting to one that is a competency based system. As a K-12 educator, as someone who works in what I consider to be a high performing school district, as we've engaged in these conversations about what it might take in order to start to make these shifts. We do realize that it's going to require a different type of work in order to make that happen. And so as we've looked at the initial proposal that included English, math, social studies, and science, what we were able to do was actually use some of our data to engage in some predictive analytics to see what that might look like actually in our system right now. And what you begin to start to look at is you can very easily point to some of the data points that are associated with the ACT exam or how high our students are scoring on those particular measures. And what it has created is a lot of conversation, I would say, in our system about what it would take in order to get our students to those points of 18 and 19 in English and math, or even as we look at some of the other points that have been there on the system. So as we have started to engage in these conversations, one of the things that we've really kind of thought about is our system right now, particularly in Cherry Creek, we feel is very well designed for a seat time-based system. We are proud of the graduation rates that we produce every single year, and we continue to get better at those graduation rates. However, as we start to think about what that means in transitioning to competency, that shift will have to happen immediately because the students are in our system currently. That class of 2021 is here now. And so there's been a lot of thought and a lot of thinking in terms of what might we need to do different. Obviously for our students in sixth grade backward in order for that to prepare them for this. So we are certainly committed to trying to make sure that we can increase our outcomes for all of our kids, but we certainly, as I've been a member of this conversation, we've wanted to be thoughtful in terms of the implementation of this as we move forward, specifically because what we do understand is that a high school diploma, much like other types of certificates, has universal application across the country. And so what we mean in terms of a high school diploma in Colorado and the expectations of what that might mean, obviously we want to position our children and our students to be situated for whatever careers and choices they might make once they move beyond the state, if that's a choice that they happen to make. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Huck-Cobb. Are we completed here?
Madam Chair, we have as much time as the agenda allows and you allow for questions, either of the panel or of the three of us. We had originally slated this to be a 90-minute item, which would end in 6 minutes.
No, that's okay.
Of course, I will defer to you as to how much time you want to allow for Q&A.
Dr. Hammond and I just have been discussing this up here. Because we canceled that item on the agenda, 701, we can add time. And we could add 30 minutes for question and answer. However, I have been requested that we take a 5-minute break before we do that. So we will take a 5-minute break, and then we'll return and discuss this very interesting subject. Thank you.